suffering genocide continue unhindered? What is your response to that question right now?
Right now, with the arrest of Dr. Hussam Al-Safiyyeh, where is the British Medical Association? Where is the American Medical Association? Where are the Royal Colleges? Where are the French Medical Association? Western medical institutions, their moral bankruptcy has become so astounding during this genocide. For them to become part of a genocidal enablement apparatus, for their silence, and in a lot of times their collusion to silence those who speak out against the genocide. For me, as a health professional, you're shocked at how completely empty of any moral value these medical associations have become when they have become complicit in a televised genocide which targets doctors.
You know, I'm speaking to you here in Cairo. In May, Germany did not allow you in to speak. You are a British Palestinian doctor. Since you were in Gaza last year, you've been speaking out about what's happening. Explain exactly what happened. I mean, Human Rights Watch and other groups were demanding that this ban be lifted. They banned you from where?
So I was invited to speak at a conference in Germany. I was stopped at Berlin Airport and was told that I'm banned from going into Germany for a month. And I was deported at the end of that day back to the UK. A few months later, I had an invitation from the French Senate. When I arrived at Charles de Gaulle Airport, I discovered that the Germans, a few days after they deported me, had put in a ban for the whole of the Schengen. And Schengen is the EU plus Norway plus Sweden plus Switzerland. Using an administrative law so that they wouldn't have to put it in front of the judge. We then were able to challenge that and have it overturned. But at the same time, pro-Israel groups like UK Lawyers for Israel submitted multiple complaints against me with the General Medical Council to have my medical license removed. Submitted complaints against me with the Charity Commission in the UK to have me banned for life from ever holding office in a UK registered charity. This is why this genocide has continued unhindered and unchallenged for over 14 months. There are apparatus of genocide enablement that exist in the West, either through collusion or by actively targeting. Over 60 doctors in the UK have had complaints against them with the General Medical Council to have their medical licenses removed as a result of their support of the Palestinians during the genocide.
Finally, Dr. Abusita, Jimmy Carter died yesterday at the age of 100. He wrote the book in the 2000s, which is quite amazing, but after he was president, Palestine Peace or Apartheid. I'm going to rejoin Nermeen for the end of the show, an interview I did with him on that issue. But your thoughts on President Carter?
The logic of the relationship between the Zionist colonialist movement and the Palestinian indigenous population has always been that of elimination. At a certain point, and that's unfortunately now behind us since the 7th of October, apartheid separation was the chosen method of elimination of the Palestinians. On the 7th of October, the Israelis crossed that genocidal Rubicon that settler colonial projects cross. And once the genocidal Rubicon is crossed, the elimination of the indigenous population by the settler colonial project then purely becomes genocidal. Israel, even at the end of this genocidal war in Gaza, will not be able to deal with the Palestinians in a non-genocidal way. Once the settler colonial project becomes genocidal, it cannot undo itself. We've seen that in North America with the killing of the children in Canada. We've seen that in Australia. We've seen that everywhere.
And Carter, again, as we just have 30 seconds, writing the book Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Well, Carter had a historic opportunity to change the course of this struggle. Had he insisted that part of the Camp David Accords was the creation of a Palestinian state, and no amount of recantation will ever change that missed opportunity. He could have forced on the Israeli government, and the first right-wing Israeli government at that point under Begin, he could have forced the creation of a Palestinian state, but he failed to do that.
And finally, Dr. Hassan Abu Sita, we just have 30 seconds. You just said that genocidal settler colonial project cannot undo itself. How do you see this ending then?
You see, the world is has a choice, because surplus populations like the Palestinians, like refugees crossing the Mediterranean, like the poor people in the favelas and in the inner city slums, these will either be dealt with through a genocidal project, as Israel has dealt with the Palestinians in Gaza. And this kind of response or this kind of template will become part of the military doctrine that is taught to armies across the world in dealing with these surplus populations.
Dr. Hassan Abu Sita, thank you so much for joining us, a British-Palestinian reconstructive surgeon who worked in Gaza as a volunteer with Doctors Without Borders, treating patients at both Al-Shifa and Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital. Amy will rejoin us for our last segment, talking about her interview with former President Jimmy Carter, who died Sunday at age 100. But up next, we'll speak to Israeli-American scholar Omer Bartov, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University, who's just back from Israel and says it's carrying out a combination of, quote, genocidal actions, ethnic cleansing, and annexation of the Gaza Strip. Back in a minute. Stranger in My Homeland by Hossam Hayek. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. As 2024 winds down, new details from Gaza's health ministry confirm more than 108,000 Palestinians have been injured in Israel's onslaught since October 7, 2023, and more than 45,500 killed, though the true toll is thought to be far higher. Meanwhile, Gaza's officials continue to accuse Israel of deliberately blocking aid deliveries, and UNRWA has warned of a, quote, approaching famine in Gaza, where residents face severe food insecurity. This comes as thousands of Israelis protested against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government Saturday, demanding an end to the war in Gaza and a ceasefire that would bring home the hostages still held by Hamas. Our next guest says Israel is carrying out a combination of, quote, genocidal actions, ethnic cleansing, and annexation of the Gaza Strip. Omer Bartov is professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. He's an Israeli-American scholar who's been described by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum as one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. He was recently in Israel and just returned earlier this month. Professor Bartov, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could begin by explaining why you think now a genocide is occurring in Gaza.
Yeah, thank you for having me again. I just want to start by saying that I was listening to the interview with Dr. Abu Sitta, and I'd just like to express my appreciation for all the work that he's been doing and everything that he was saying in the previous segment. I started, as you may know, already in November 2023. I published an op-ed in the New York Times where I wrote that I thought the IDF was carrying out what appeared to be war crimes or crimes against humanity, but I was not yet convinced that we had enough evidence that this was genocidal action. And my view changed really around May 2024 with the decision of the IDF, despite opposition from the United States, to invade Rafah, the last area of the Gaza Strip that had not been taken over. There were about a million Palestinians there who had already been displaced several times, and the IDF displaced them one more time to the beach area, the Mawasi area, without any proper infrastructure at all, into tent cities along the beach. And then proceeded to demolish much of Rafah. And it was at that point that I started looking back at the entire operation, starting with statements made at the very beginning in October 7th, 8th, 9th by Israeli leaders, political and military leaders with executive authority, who were saying that they wanted to flatten Gaza, destroy it, that there were no people who were uninvolved, and so forth. And it appeared at that point that there was actually a systematic attempt to make Gaza uninhabitable, as well as to destroy all institutions that make it possible for a group to sustain itself, not only physically, but also culturally, its identity, its collective memory, which meant a systematic destruction of universities, of schools, of mosques, of museums, and of course of housing and infrastructure. So what you could see by then was that there was what we would call an herbicide, an attempt to destroy the urban centers, physically destroy them, a scholasticide, that is killing of the members of the educational institutions of schools, professors at universities, and so forth, so that the population, having been displaced many times, and as you heard before, vast numbers of them being killed, wounded, and debilitated, would never be able to reconstitute itself as a group in that area. That's the general drift of it. Now, as of early October this year, that is a year after the war began, the IDF started an operation in the northern part of Gaza, north of the so-called Netzarim corridor, which is now not really a corridor. It's like a box about 5 miles wide and 5 miles long, emptying that area north of that corridor entirely of its population. And this was a plan that was being sold by retired Israeli general, Giora Eiland, on Israeli TV for months before. And the idea is to force the entire population out through military action and through starvation, through depriving that population of food and water. And much of the population has indeed been removed. This last attack on the hospital you were discussing earlier is one additional phase in this attempt to make this entire area empty of its population. This has been called by the former Israeli chief of staff and minister of defense, who is himself a political hawk, on the Israeli media, an operation of ethnic cleansing. But ethnic cleansing means that you move people from a place where you don't want them, a particular ethnic group, to another place where they can be at least secure of those attacks. But of course, in Gaza, when you move people from one place to another, to so-called safe zones, they are not safe there, and they do come increasingly and constantly again under attack. So that's what makes this so-called ethnic cleansing actually part of a genocidal operation. As for annexation, what we hear a lot now on the Israeli media is that as this northern third of Gaza is being flattened and emptied of its population, there are in fact settler groups waiting in the wings just across the fence to move in and to start settling that area with an eye to occupying it entirely. And I don't see, if they do that, once the army lets them in, I don't see any mechanism in Israel itself or, frankly, internationally, that would remove them from there. So that would be the beginning of a creeping annexation and resettlement of Gaza as it is being emptied of its Palestinian population.
Well, Professor Bartov, I want to ask about the enablers of this, as you say, genocide. In a Guardian piece last week, headlined, "A consensus is emerging, Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Where is the action?" Columnist Nasreen Malik condemns Western complicity in what's occurring in Gaza, writing, quote, "The danger now is that Palestinians die twice. Once in physical reality and second in a moral one, where the powerful diminish the very standards that shape the world as we know it. By refusing even to accept the designations of genocide and ethnic cleansing, let alone act upon them, Israel's allies force an adaptation onto the world after which it simply becomes accepted that rights are not bestowed by humanity, but by the parties who decide who is human." So that's Nasreen Malik writing in The Guardian. Professor Bartov, could you respond to that? And in particular, a genocide, as you say, is occurring in Gaza. The genocide would not be possible without the complicity and direct involvement of Western powers, in particular, the United States. So in that sense, is the U.S. also, by association, guilty of committing genocide?
Yes, look, I mean, I would begin by saying that first and foremost, the population that is most responsible for what Israel is doing right now is the population of Israel. And that there is a deep complicity of the Israeli population, including not only the government, but opposition parties in Israel, which are supporting the operation in Gaza. So we can talk about that. But of course, Israel cannot and would not be able to continue its actions in Gaza without complete support, especially from the United States, also from European countries, Germany foremost, but also in many ways France and the UK. The U.S. administration under Biden could have ended this war as early as November or December 2023, because Israel cannot conduct such operations on such a scale without constant assistance from the United States, first of all, by the vast amount of munitions that are going to Israel on a daily basis, tank and artillery shells, interceptor rockets. All of this is coming on a vast scale from the United States to the tune now of about $20 billion being paid by the American taxpayer. Had an American administration said to Netanyahu in December 2023, "You have to wrap this up or you're on your own," he would have had to stop because it would just simply be impossible. But instead, this was not done. And the result of that is, obviously, first of all, the massive destruction of Gaza. Second, it means that the entire edifice of international law that was put into place in the wake of World War II and the Holocaust, in order to prevent genocide ever happening again, through the Nuremberg Tribunal, through the Genocide Convention of 1948, the Geneva Accords of 1949, and so forth, and now the Rome Statute more recently, all this apparatus has been shown as meaningless if a country like Israel, supported by its Western allies, can act with impunity. And the result of this is that all other rogue states in the world could now say, well, if Israel can get away with it, why should we not? And so in that sense, this is a total moral, ethical failure by the very countries that claim to be the main protectors of civil rights, democracy, human rights around the world. And it's apart from the regional catastrophe that is happening right now, this has much larger ramifications for what we will see in the future.
And Professor Bartov, so you just mentioned, of course, you were in Israel just earlier this month. You spoke to a large number of people there. What is your sense of how Gaza is being perceived? Is there criticism now, much wider and broader criticism of Israel's actions in Gaza than there was, say, earlier this year in the summer when you were there, or last year?
So, yeah, I was in Israel in June 2024. And at the time, when I spoke with people and even mentioned what was going on in Gaza, and most of the people I speak with are mainstream, liberal, left-leaning, there was huge reluctance to even speak about it. People were completely caught up with the sense of trauma and pain following the October 7th Hamas attack, which killed about 900 civilians as well as several hundred soldiers. When I was visiting Israel this time, just earlier this month, I had a sense that more people were aware of what was happening in Gaza, not because of Israeli TV, which is still entirely blocking out voluntarily any real reports from Gaza, or these reports are filtered through what the army, the information given them by the army. But there have been newspaper reports. There have been a lot of social media reports. So more people, I think, are aware now of what is happening there. But how are they responding to that? My sense is that there's a growing sense of resignation, of despair, of hopelessness in those circles that one would hope would be the main opposition to the policies of an extreme
right-wing
government.
Professor Bartov, I'm so sorry that we're out of time. We're going to have to end it there. Professor Bartov Omer Bartov, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. He's an Israeli-American scholar who's been described by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum as one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. We'll be back in a minute.
Find the light that guides you through a cloudy day. When the stars ain't shining bright, you feel like you've lost your way. When the candle led her home.
Soul Shine by the Allman Brothers Band. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York, joined by Amy Goodman in Cairo. Former President Jimmy Carter died Sunday at his home in Plains, Georgia. He was 100 years old. The 39th president served a single tumultuous term in the White House from 1977 to 1981. He's remembered as a man of deeply held faith who helped negotiate a landmark peace deal between Israel and Egypt that holds to this day. Carter was also a committed Cold Warrior who began funneling arms to the Afghan Mujahideen to fight the Soviet Union in 1979. He continued to support right-wing authoritarian governments in Latin America and beyond. His austerity politics also hastened the Democratic Party's neoliberal turn, further cemented by his defeat to Ronald Reagan in 1980. In retirement, he devoted himself to causes including election integrity and building homes for low-income people. In 2006, he stirred controversy with his book Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, in which he compared Israel's treatment of Palestinians to South Africa's former racist government. As we begin our look back at Carter's life and legacy this week, Amy, you did a series of interviews with President Carter.
Yes, I did. And this is a clip we're going to play from an interview I did with him in 2007 on his book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
President Carter, I wanted to switch gears to talk about the raging controversy over your book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
I didn't know it was still raging, but that's interesting.
Well, it raged for a while, yeah. And now the book is coming out in paperback with a new afterword, and you dealt with that. You talked about it being perhaps the most controversial thing that you've done, maybe to your surprise. So start with the title. Talk about the message you're trying to put out with this book.
Well, the message is very clear. It deals with Palestine. You're not inside Israel itself, just the Palestinian occupied territories. And the second word is peace. I describe in this book the efforts for peace so far and my formula, which I think is very reasonable, for bringing peace to Israel and to Israel's neighbors. And I repeat that over and over with a strong condemnation of any kind of terrorism that afflicts innocent people by the actions of either the Palestinians or the Israelis. And the word apartheid is exactly accurate. You know, this is an area that's occupied by two powers. They're now completely separated. The Palestinians can't even ride on the same roads that the Israelis have created or built in Palestinian territory. The Israelis never see a Palestinian except the Israeli soldiers. The Palestinians never see an Israeli except at a distance, except the Israeli soldiers. So within Palestinian territory, they're absolutely and totally separated, much worse than they were in South Africa, by the way. And the other thing is, the other definition of apartheid is one side dominates the other, and the Israelis completely dominate the life of the Palestinian people.
Why don't Americans know what you have seen?
Americans don't want to know, and many Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that is far transcends what any outsider would imagine. And there are powerful political forces in America that prevents any objective analysis of the problem in the Holy Land. I think it's accurate to say that not a single member of Congress with whom I'm familiar would possibly speak out and call for Israel to withdraw to their legal boundaries or to publicize the plight of the Palestinians, or even to call publicly and repeatedly for good faith peace talks. There hadn't been a day of peace talks now in more than 7 years. So this is a taboo subject, and I would say that if any member of Congress did speak out, as I've just described, they would probably not be back into Congress the next term.
Who are these forces that you're talking about?
Well, there's an inherent commitment in America, which I share as a Christian, of a deep commitment to make sure that Israel is safe and that Israel is free, and that they can seek for peace. So there's a strong inclination for all of us to support Israel's continued existence in peace. And that is added on to by the very effective work of the American-Israeli group called AIPAC, which is performing its completely legitimate task of convincing Americans to support the policies of the Israeli government. And AIPAC is not dedicated to peace. They're dedicated to inducing the maximum support in America, in the White House, in the Congress, and in the public media for whatever policies the Israeli government has at a particular time, and they're extremely effective.
Former President Jimmy Carter on Democracy Now! In 2007. Watch all our interviews with him at democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Cairo. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
F90.1 FM.